Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza. And for those of you that have been listening and sending in questions and comments, thank you so much. And what I'd like to do is acknowledge a couple of you by reading them. One reads, "What a great show with meaningful topics that focus on improving people's lives. I'm so glad I found this show." Another one reads, "Answers for the Family truly does facilitate having the answers." Thank you. Well, first of all, you're welcome, and thank you so much. And please continue to help spread the word that every Monday from 11 a.m. to noon Pacific time, this show will bring on special guests that can inspire, educate, and in some cases entertain, while bringing answers and options to making our lives happier, healthier, and more successful. Now, you can all do me a big favor. Please forward one of our shows to your social media group or to someone that you know that can benefit from a particular show. And I can guarantee you everybody knows somebody that can benefit from this show. Now, Answers for the Family will continue to address a variety of issues such as family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and so much more. And we'll introduce you to talented authors and new innovations in the areas of health, security, and sometimes fun for you and your family. Now, our topic today is also the title of our guest's new book, When Food is Comfort. So stay with us as our guest explains how we can move beyond compulsive behaviors and preoccupation with eating and weight. We can eliminate the idea of dieting from our life forever and experience a fuller and more satisfying life. And that's no pun intended. Now with us is Julie Simon, a licensed psychotherapist and life coach with a full-time private practice specializing in eating issues, weight loss, body image challenges, and associated mood disturbances such as depression and anxiety. She has always been passionate about helping others, wanting to help people thrive by achieving body, mind, and spirit health. She has spent the last 2.5 decades doing just that. Now, Julie's professional experience with and her personal journey through childhood trauma, weight challenges, and body and brain chemistry imbalances led to the creation of the 12-week emotional eating recovery coaching program. Now, the program, which runs many times per year, and it's been doing so for 20-plus years, offers clients an alternative to dieting by addressing the mind, body, and spirit issues underlying overeating. Now, in addition to the 12-week program, she offers seminars and workshops throughout the year at various venues on several topics related to overeating, as well as ongoing weekly groups for women who eat for emotional comfort. Julie, welcome back to Answers for the Family.
Thank you so much. It's great to be back with you.
Well, the time has flown by because I was thinking about it, and it seems like it wasn't very long ago. But now, as we look at it, I think it's closer to maybe 3 years ago. So I know that we're talking about something very similar in regards to the topic, but I have a feeling that some things have changed. But before we get into all of that, for those people that didn't hear the show before, tell us about how you came to be doing this work and what inspired you to write books about it.
Well, you know, the reason I came to do this work is that I myself struggled for so many years with overeating, gaining weight, went on every diet known to womankind. And throughout all those years, I always had this intuitive sense that we were not meant to count calories, carbohydrate, and fat grams, weigh and measure our food or weigh and measure our bodies. I knew that eating had to be more intuitive. Our ancestors didn't do all that. Animals in the wild don't do all that. So I was kind of on a quest for many years in my own life to figure out the pieces, all the pieces of the overeating puzzle. And once I had put a lot of those pieces together for myself, I knew that I wanted to help others do that. And that's one of the main reasons I became a psychotherapist and life coach, was to help people deal with primarily overeating challenges, but emotional eating in particular, stress eating. And I've been doing it ever since.
Well, then the first question, I think, along that line is, how does one know if they're an emotional eater?
Well, I think that's a great, you know, it's a great question. And I usually like to go over some examples of what it might look like if you're an emotional eater, because then people can really get a feel for what it looks like. So, for example, if you use food as a tranquilizer to dull emotions that are difficult to cope with, such as anxiety, anger, sadness, frustration, hopelessness, loneliness, shame, guilt, and even happiness and excitement and joy, emotional eaters use food to calm themselves when they're experiencing unpleasant bodily sensations, such as agitation or nervousness or muscle tension. Perhaps as an emotional eater, you're turning to food for soothing and comfort, or you're turning to food for pleasure, escape, fulfillment, and excitement. We all do a little bit of that.
Mm-hmm.
Eating when you're stressed out, eating when you feel numb, you're not aware of any feelings, eating when you feel overwhelmed or you feel paralyzed and you can't seem to get to your to-do list. Many people turn to food to silence negative, critical, self-defeating thoughts, to quiet their mind. Many people eat to distract themselves from low motivation states like boredom, lethargy, or apathy. We can eat to procrastinate. You may be eating because your life is lacking purpose, meaning, passion, and inspiration. And you may be trying to fill up an inner emptiness with food. So there's an example of an emotional eating checklist in the book. There's an example of some of the things on that list that might help you identify whether you're an emotional eater or not.
Well, and along those lines, can you share a little bit about the difference between when the body is sending a hunger signal and the body is sending a craving signal?
Well, you know, in fact, all of that can be very confusing for people.
Right.
our bodies are incredibly wise, and they actually send us hunger signals. Hormones get stimulated when we need to, you know, take in calories, and we'll get signals like a rumbling tummy or an empty feeling or lightheaded. We also have cravings, like you said. So, you know, you may open up the refrigerator and notice that the nectarines look good, but the fish doesn't. Or, you know, you're really craving carbohydrate and the rice and potatoes look good, but not the fruit. You know, cravings, our bodies are so wise, they give us cravings. And they also give us fullness signals when it's time to stop eating. And if we pay attention to all the signals, you know, with love and care and curiosity, we can really begin to learn how to regulate all of that. But then sometimes we're going to notice that, of course, we feel like we're having cravings for things that aren't so healthy for our bodies, for sugar, for lots of processed food, maybe caffeine, maybe nicotine. You know, maybe we're having addictive cravings. And that's a sign that something's out of balance. We do have normal cravings, of course, but we can have kind of compulsive cravings. Sign that something's out of balance, and then we need to begin digging a little bit further and understanding, you know, for example, why are we having so many sugar cravings? And in fact, is it cravings that are leading us to select those foods, or is it more emotional hunger? And oftentimes emotional hunger can feel like physical hunger. So it can be a little confusing.
Now, you just mentioned self-regulation, and I know in your book you talk about mastering the skill of self-regulation. Could you explain what your definition of self-regulation means in this context?
Yeah, well, you know, one of the most common causes of overeating and weight gain is difficulty regulating our emotions, our moods, our thoughts, our disruptive impulses, which sometimes feel like cravings, as we just said, and our behaviors. And so self-regulation is a very important skill. And in order for us to master the skill, the upstairs logical and soothing part of our brain must be well connected or properly wired with the downstairs emotional brain. And so if someone typically finds themselves regularly turning to external sources such as food or alcohol for comfort, they may actually be under the influence of that emotional part of the brain. The wiring of the brain, the way the brain got wired when you were young, is contributing to a higher level of emotional reactivity, and that's part of what's probably contributing to cravings and grabbing substances.
Well, and again, and that's something that I know you also talk about in part one of the book, you know, on how the chronic stressful interactions or neglect at an early age can wire your brain and your nervous system, as you're saying, like for high arousal. And we know that that makes it more difficult for us to soothe or comfort ourselves. I'm a firm believer that we can rewire our brains. So can you share one of your techniques that works best and where people in this context can rewire their brain?
Yeah, and before I do, I just wanted to say that, you know, what's so wonderful is that recent advances in brain science have uncovered the crucial role that our early social and emotional environment plays in the development of imbalanced eating patterns. And when we don't receive consistent and sufficient emotional nurturance during our early years, that's when our brain and nervous system are getting wired, and they become wired, like I said before, for high arousal. So it makes it more difficult for us to soothe and comfort ourselves, and it leaves us at greater risk for seeking comfort from external sources. So this second book is all about teaching a practice, a mindfulness practice that I teach in my 12-week program called Inner Nurturing. And so even if you didn't get the kind of nurturing you needed, and this is never about bashing parents because, you know, parenting is the hardest job in the world, and your parents or caregivers may have been very, very loving, but sometimes if they were missing particular skills, you may not have had consistent or sufficient enough nurturance for your brain to get wired properly. So this is a 7-skill mindfulness practice that will help you to rewire those connections, because instead of external attunement, we need something called attunement to wire our brains properly, someone really tuning into our emotional states. In this book, you'll learn internal attunement. You'll learn how to do that for yourself. And one of the first skills is called pop the hood. And it really is just going inside and identifying what you're feeling, identifying your emotions, and learning to identify your bodily sensations. Sometimes it's easier to start with those if you don't know exactly what you're feeling. And, you know, we learn how to identify and track emotion and stay present to it. And that's a mindfulness practice, and it's a very important part of rewiring the brain.
Now, one of our guests had described what I thought was great as far as a great visual, which is to think of the brain as a snow-covered mountain, and that as you're skiing down it, you're making grooves in it. And you're, you know, as you continue to make these grooves, a lot of people will stay in the same groove for a long time. And said that what we need to do is to go in and to make new paths. And we have a tendency to get stuck in that path. How long do you think it takes to be able to go in, you know, if you have a situation to where we've gotten into this habit, you know, of overeating or habit of soothing through food, to put a new groove in, you know, or to set up a new path, a new comfort level that makes us want to no longer go the route that we used to go for that type of soothing.
Well, you know, it's funny when you ask the how long does it take questions, because I have people, you know, who sign up for my 12-week program, and they'll always say, well, how long does it take, and how soon will I, you know, be done with this problem? And I always have kind of the same answer. It's like, how much are you willing to practice, you know, the skills that I teach you? Because I could teach you all the skills you'll need, and and, in fact, add things to that from my first book, for example, like some people have hormonal imbalances and brain chemistry imbalances and food allergies. So we'll address it all. But the question is, how fast can you move? How fast can you shift? So a good example, I can use myself as an example. long before I knew the neuroscience behind what I was doing, I knew that there was something called cognitive therapy, and I knew that my thoughts were very critical and negative and judgmental of myself and others, and I wanted to change that. I had come from very critical parenting, and I remember thinking at that time in my life, how could I change the way I think, you know, these kind of automatic thoughts that come up, how could I change this? I can't just, you know, go get a CD and plug in a new one in my head. At the time, I didn't call it a CD, like a tape. So I thought, how would I do this? When I learned about cognitive therapy, I thought, oh my God, I can kind of catch the thoughts that I'm having, the negative, judgmental, shaming, critical thoughts, and I can reframe them with something more calming or soothing or energizing or even a neutral thought if I can't come up with anything else. And I committed myself, I committed to doing this, catching and reframing a minimum of two thoughts a day for one solid year. And the result was like mind-blowing. I felt like a new person. And in the process, and this is where I began to explore this idea of an inner nurturing voice. In the process, I was also building an inner nurturing voice. I was building a voice that was kind and loving and supportive. I hadn't come from that kind of parenting. So I was borrowing it. I was borrowing it from my therapist. I was borrowing it from, you know, moms on television shows. I was borrowing a voice that I didn't have. And I slowly developed that voice, and my brain was getting rewired. So that was an example of a year's worth of work. I don't think this work is fast, but it's definitely doable.
Yeah, and I mean, I like that answer because it really touches on the fact that what you're saying, it's all about how much work you're going to put in it. In other words, you know, there's no magic to it. You know, you still have to put in the work. You still have to practice to rewire your, you know, your brain.
If someone asked you how long will it take for me to be a great guitar player, right? How much practice are you going to do?
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Are you
going to practice 4 hours a day? You're going to get pretty good, pretty fast.
Yeah, and if it's 4 minutes a day, it could take a real long time.
Right.
So, I had a smile come to my face when you mentioned about, you know, you can't plug a CD in, and then said, well, wait a minute. When I first started thinking about this, it was actually a cassette, and I was doing a seminar, and I made the motion, and I said, what you're trying to do is you need to change the channel. And I made a motion, I stuck my arm out, and I turned my wrist, you know, as if I was changing the channel on a TV. And and three or four people, they just went, like, dumbfounded. Their eyes glassed over, and one of them says, what are you doing? And I said, change like this. And then I switched to it, and I went, okay. So I took my thumb, and I pressed on top of it, and I said, changing the channel, okay? I realized that my young audience had no idea because they've never walked up to a TV and turned anything with their wrist. Anyway, so yes, we learn that there are different techniques to do things. But so anyway, it brought a smile to my face. So yeah, I like the fact that what we're talking about is it's like anything else. You know, put the work in, and reading the book and doing things like that. It's the first step. I mean, wouldn't you agree? It's the first step in making a difference, but you have to then follow through. Is that what I hear you saying?
Yes. And, you know, I think the hopeful message that I always want to get across to people is that these are all skills that you can learn. there's skills that most likely you're either missing or you haven't practiced them, you know, fully or thoroughly, or you're not practicing them regularly. But they're all skills that you can learn. So if you're struggling with overeating, emotional eating, stress eating, you can learn to practice these skills slowly or as fast as you want, and you will begin to see differences in how you are coping and managing your life, and that's because your brain's getting rewired. So it's very hopeful. I know when I was struggling with all this stuff, I really didn't have, even though I sought out therapists, I really never had anyone say to me, you're missing some skills, and I can teach them to you. And that would have been so hopeful to me. I was kind of finding them and discovering them, you know, on my own. But it would have been so helpful to me if someone said, here's how you do it. You know, just like if we use our guitar playing example again.
Sure.
You know, here's what you do, and you go through these steps, and then over time, you know, even though it'll feel clunky when you have to place your fingers on the frets and the strumming feels clunky, at some point it's going to flow, and it's going to feel really natural. And that's how inner nurturing is. It's clunky at first, and you kind of don't feel like sitting down and, you know, writing down what you're feeling and identifying what your needs are and bringing in that inner nurturing voice. But as you practice it, you start to find that it's bearing fruit and that you're actually feeling better in your life. And, you know, you have a pal in inner nurturing, you know, we're learning to access an inner supportive voice. So you're starting to find out that you have a friend, a cheerleader, someone who encourages you, someone who says kind things to you. I mean, who doesn't want that
sure.
in their head all day?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yep. Well, we have a message coming in and going along the lines that we're talking about that you need to put in the work. But we have somebody that is emailing in that says, I have tried everything, meditation, hypnotherapy, tapping, you name it, and I still have these horrible night cravings. Munchy foods are the only thing that seems to satisfy. And as you aptly put, comforts the beast. Before I buy the book, can you explain how your process is different from the other things I've tried? This says, thanks, Mark in Los Angeles.
That's a really good question. And it really makes me think of some people in my current 12-week program where we've been working on those nighttime cravings and learning how to surf that urge, right? To kind of find out a craving is just a craving and it doesn't always have to be given into. But there's probably nothing new about what I just said, but maybe the newer part is that what I teach in both books actually is when you are developing this inner nurturing voice, this voice is the voice that actually sets limits. So this voice morphs into what I call the inner limit setter. And most people, when they're trying to set limits with themselves, they access more of an inner critic. You know, you need to stop. You know, you can't have any more cookies tonight. That's it. Right? What I teach is to dialogue. So for Mark, for example, late at night when you're having those cravings, ask that young part of yourself, what is there not enough of? Okay, right now it just feels maybe like a gnawing for cookies or popcorn or ice cream or something. But ask that young part of yourself, what I call the feeling self, what is there not enough of tonight? Is there not enough love? Is there not enough fun? Now, sometimes, I do want to put a caveat in there, sometimes cravings are physiological. I mean, some of us do just seem to get more sugar cravings late at night, you know, changes in hormonal chemistry. And even if they're physical, we still, if we don't want to indulge in them, we still have to tolerate them and ride them out, okay? So the best way to tolerate them and ride them out is to bring in this inner nurturing voice. So the voice says, I see, Mark, that you want to have another dish of ice cream, but we need to stop. We already had one dish. So that young part of you, Mark, says, no, I'm not done. Now I want cookies. I really want cookies. So the inner limit setter says, well, we're not going to have cookies, but I'm here with you, I love you, I care about you, and I want to find out, what is there not enough of? What are you really needing tonight? Okay? If it's just a physiological craving, we have to kind of learn how to surf that urge and go do something else, go to bed. You know, I know this is nothing new, this part. If it's emotional, that's where the inner nurture comes in. The inner nurture is going to explore, what is it that you're really feeling? What is it that you're needing? Maybe you say, I'm lonely, and I really need a companion. I need some connection. Well, the food isn't going to ultimately fill that need. So the inner nurture is there to say, I'm here with you. I know you're feeling alone, but I'm always here with you. I'm closer than your breath. And together, we can figure out ways that we can bring in more connection. So you have a best friend there to help you through anything, help you meet any of the needs that you're having. Does that make sense?
Oh, it makes perfect sense. And I know you touch in your book about, you know, that there's a connection between eating issues and depression. But we're going to take a break right now. So for everybody, please stay with us. When we come back, we're going to talk about that connection. But in the meantime, for those of you that are you're at your office or you're somewhere where you can go online, if you want to follow along with us, you can go to www.overeatingrecovery.com. You can follow along with us. Obviously, don't do this if you're driving. But for the rest of you, follow along with us. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back. You're listening to Answers for the Family.
Founded over 30 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, Westshield has continually focused on resolving issues that negatively impact families and businesses. Our signature therapeutic transportation service helps to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely transported to specialized schools, programs, and treatment centers with unsurpassed experience and success. We are supported by our full-service licensed investigation agency that has legally, professionally, and compassionately located hundreds of runaways and teens. We are experienced and qualified to help, offering solutions which may include referrals to our international network of top professionals in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, psychiatry, and investigations. Simply put, Westshield Adolescent Services and Westshield Investigations are the best solutions when your family is facing a personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's 1-800-899-8585. Or visit our website at westshield.com. Thank you.
And we're back. This is Alan Cardoza. You're listening to Answers for the Family. And with us is Julie M. Simon. And we are talking about her new book, When Food is Comfort. And when we went to the break, I posed the question, and I asked Julie to share with us a little bit about the connection between eating issues and depression.
Well, you know, I think there isn't any specific connection between eating issues and depression or any other particular emotion. But I think that, you know, probably what you're getting at is, again, that issue of, if we didn't have sufficient or consistent, you know, nurturance when we were young, we may find, you know, that we're having lower moods more often. It could be low-level depression, like what we call dysthymia, or it could even be major depression. And many emotional eaters eat because of low moods, because they're feeling depressed, because they're feeling unmotivated, because their lives aren't feeling fulfilled. And again, what we're going to be wanting to learn to do is to nurture ourselves. We need to learn those skills as to how we can handle depression, even anxiety. I mean, many, many emotional eaters who come to me struggle with one or both, you know, depression and anxiety. And often the depression is because there isn't that nourishing voice inside comforting them, soothing them, encouraging them, providing hope. And often for those that struggle with anxiety, again, there isn't that voice that's providing security, that's saying, you're safe here with me. We're going to be okay. We'll always be okay. Because the reality is, for all of us in bodies, right, out in the world, there is no ultimate sense of security. You know, any minute a terrorist, you know, can enter a department store, or, you know, so we need to have, or we could be on a plane and it's, you know, getting bumpy and we're afraid it's going to crash, or it could be an earthquake. There's so much in life that's challenging for all of us to deal with. And even our mothers or caregivers or our partners may not be there when something's happening. So we all need to develop a voice inside that can always comfort us, always soothe us if we're down, always lift us up, always give us hope or help us move towards finding hope, calm us, soothe us, calm our anxiety, right? So no matter what emotional challenges we're struggling with, ultimately we need to have that voice.
Now, and I know that you've talked a lot about the inner voice that we're talking about, but I think also there is trying to put supportive people around us, more nurturing people around us, and some emotional leaders really have difficulty attracting nurturing people into their lives. And I know you mentioned in part three in your book, you cover there were six sabotaging interpersonal behavior patterns that emerge that emotional eaters engage in. And what are those sabotaging things, and what are some of the empowering strategies that can transform those behaviors? Can you share a few of those with us?
Yes, and first let me say that, you know, many emotional eaters, when they've learned the skills of inner nurturing, so just real briefly, because we didn't cover what those skills were, you know, learning how to identify where your emotions are, learning how to validate your emotions and bodily sensations, learning how to validate those emotions and bodily sensations, bringing in that inner nurturing voice, excuse me, developing that inner nurturing voice, learning how to identify your needs, catching and reframing those self-defeating thoughts. So those are some of the skills that we work on in terms of inner nurturing. And many emotional eaters, when they learn these seven skills in the book, they come back and they say, oh my God, I wish I had people in my life that knew how to nurture me. You know, now that I'm learning how to nurture myself, I wish I had those kind of people. And often we need to look at some of the patterns that emotional eaters have developed over time that have actually sabotaged their success at calling in, if you will, other nurturing people. So, for example, patterns of attracting emotionally unavailable people, perhaps people like their caregivers. Maybe their caregivers were emotionally unavailable. So they have a pattern of gravitating towards emotionally unavailable people. And one of the strategies I teach for dealing with that is to learn to practice gravitating towards the warmth. So even if someone isn't going to be your next best friend, gravitate towards someone who's warm, friendly, emotionally available. Learn how to feel what that energy feels like of those kind of people. Another pattern, sabotaging pattern that many emotional eaters engage in is people pleasing. Constantly trying to please other people. Empowering strategy for that I teach is learning how to practice self-assertion instead of just automatically people pleasing. To learn how to check in with yourself and see what your needs are in a particular situation. Another sabotaging pattern is caregiving, doing too much caregiving. And those can seem similar, but they're different, people-pleasing and caregiving. So that's a few of the few patterns that emotional eaters engage in that actually keep them from attracting in more nourishing others.
Now, what are the differences? Because you're right, those two did sound very similar. But we're talking about caregivers, because I think we're in an industry of caregivers, and many of the people out here, you know, that are our listeners, are caregivers, and so share with us a little bit about the differences between just people pleasing versus maybe becoming an, I guess it would be an over caregiver?
Right. It's a kind of a simple difference. Like when you're people pleasing, it relates to the way you see yourself and the way you see others. So when you're people pleasing, you see yourself as more small and needy, and you see others as more strong. And so you're constantly kind of pleasing the strong others. Even if they're not strong, you're projecting that onto them. In caregiving, you tend to see yourself as strong and others as needy. So maybe you kind of rescue a lot of people with broken wings. You rescue a lot of broken birds. So caregiving, you see yourself as strong and other people as needing rescuing or needing caretaking. And people-pleasing, you see yourself as small, yourself as needing that, and so you're pleasing the strong others. Make sense?
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. And in fact, actually, that was an excellent description. And as I think many of us fall into that category, that spells it out pretty good. Now, I know that also, in I think it's in part three in your book, Food is Comfort, you discuss how to nurture our relationships, and you talk about four habits that highly empathic people, something that they must learn to practice. So share with us a couple of these habits that would be beneficial to all of us.
Yes, well, again, I wrote about these habits because I had people who have taken my program who have said, I'm feeling so guilty because I'm learning inner nurturing and I'm realizing that I don't think I've been particularly nurturing to those closest to me. And I can't just practice the seven skills of inner nurturing on them. That's not going to work. I can do that, those skills with myself. But how would I nurture those closest to me? So I wrote about four habits that people who are highly empathic and nurturing practice. So the first habit is that when you're around someone that you care about, is to really learn how to convey interest in what's going on with them and availability, that you're available to listen. The second habit is when you do listen, is to do something called reflective listening. And I really go into that in the book, that reflective listening is something I cover in the seven skills as well, is that we don't want to always be offering solutions to people. We generally want to help people access what they're feeling and identify their emotions, their sensations, get clear on their own needs. So even when we're actively listening and we're reflectively listening, we don't jump in, we don't interrupt, we don't keep directing the conversation or trying to problem solve. We just allow someone the time and the space to express whatever they want to express and share with us whatever they want to share. And most people are actually not the greatest listeners. If you go out in your world, you'll notice that people give advice pretty quick. People jump to problem solving very fast and don't really give the other person, the benefit of the doubt that they're going to come to their own ideas and their own solutions if you give them the space, to process it. So that's what reflective listening is all about. The third habit is asking how you can help. Sometimes you can be of help to someone. Sometimes just being a good ear is of help. Get clear on how you can help rather than kind of forcing help on someone. And the fourth habit is to clarify your own boundaries, because sometimes, people will come to me and say, gee, my sister Sue is very needy and, I'd like to nurture her. I'd like to learn how to nurture her, but I feel like she's an empty well and she'll suck me in and suck me dry. And so I say, well, that's really more about you clarifying your boundaries, learning how to perhaps say, I really want to hear about what's going on for you, but I only have 20 minutes. And really enforcing that boundary. So we work on boundaries as well, which is a really important issue for everyone, but especially for emotional eaters.
Yeah, I'm now, as you're saying that, I'm thinking, okay, sign me up. So which actually brings me to the, where can emotional eaters and professionals who work with or those that work with emotional eaters or anyone that really wants to learn these skills? Because as I'm hearing you speak, these skills aren't just for, emotional eating. These are skills that I think that we can all benefit from. So where can some of us go to learn more about this?
They can for sure go to my website, which is overeatingrecovery.com. And I have lots of blog articles there, and they can download 2 free chapters from both of my books if they want to get started reading. And in the first book, we really cover a lot more. The first book is very broad. And then in the second book, we go even more specifically. You don't have to have read the first book to read the second book. The second book actually is a deeper dive into inner nurturing. So if you feel inclined to do all the reading, you might want to read the first book, The Emotional Eater's Repair Manual, first, and then read When Food is Comfort, second. And all of that is at my website.
Okay. And again, for those of you that are driving, and you can't write it down, go to our website, the Answers for the Family site, and we will have all of the information. If you are in a position, it is overeatingrecovery.com. Go to the website and get lots of very valuable information. We have another listener question or comment here that says, I love the title of your book, as it is so relevant in my life and that of so many of my friends. We were just discussing at a recent dinner how we grab for the nearest candy bar or other sweets when we're upset. And during our meals, we find ourselves overeating because we have so much stress in our lives and not even paying attention to what we're putting in our mouth. I have ordered your book and can't wait to hear the show. This is from Beverly in Nevada.
Ah, that's so wonderful. And, one thing I would say to Beverly is that food is the grand soother. I mean, there's no doubt about it. We all know exactly which foods will quiet the storm in our brain or calm down the dysregulation that's going on in our body. We all know the foods. We all know the drinks, maybe the smokes. We know what will do it. And so it's not your fault. I mean, you've actually been incredibly resourceful in finding external sources of comfort, right? That's what it is. And so what this book is all about is saying, okay, if doing that, turning to external sources, isn't working for you anymore, because we all do a certain amount of emotional eating, and there's no problem with that, a little bit here and there, but if it's not working for you anymore, you're really doing it too much of the time, then you really need to learn how to offer yourself the internal support and comfort that you're craving. And even at the most stressful points in time, I'm a walking, breathing example of recovery. I mean, I've been through all of what I take all my clients through. And in the most stressful times, I can turn inward and get what I'm looking for. And that's what everyone wants to be able to do.
Now, when we first came on, you mentioned a little bit about some of the differences in regards to the new technologies and things, that there's a lot of new information out there. So I think for many people, if you've read books in the past, think about the fact that there is a lot of things that are now different. And one of them that that I've become aware of fairly recently is the whole fat versus carbs situation, to where, I think we're now learning that there are good fats that provide energy, and things that are actually very good for us, good for our brain. And there was a time in which all of these, quote, low-fat processed foods were coming in that were saying, natural fats are bad for you. Share a little bit about that for some of the people that maybe haven't run into that piece of information yet.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's the one thing about nutrition information is that it's always changing. And I've always found that very exciting, you know, that we're always finding newer things. Like, you know, we went through all those years of the low-fat, no-fat craze only to find that our bodies actually do need fats. They need essential fatty acids. And we're now, again, kind of in a transition where we're carving out, you know, do we need, you know, animal fats? What kind of fats do we need? We're getting pretty clear that almost all vegetable oils are not so great for us, although some, I think they're saying like coconut oil is good. So we're still in that transitional phase of kind of really understanding the human body and what is our natural diet. I always say to people, you know, there are certain things that all diet gurus agree on. We all know that we need to eat nutrient-dense food. We need to eat lots of it. That's vegetables, fruits. And then there's controversy. You know, how much fats do we eat and exactly what type of fats do we eat? That's still controversial, but there's more people now talking about ketogenic diets that, you know, maybe our diets were originally more higher in fats. What I always say to people is keep an open mind, you know, that when the new information comes in, rather than say, oh, my God, like now I have to blah, 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 keep an open mind, you know, maybe some gratitude like, oh, you know, we're finding out more about this phenomenal machine and what fuels it and what doesn't, and make gentle adjustments in what you're doing. If someone comes and says you need to go ketogenic now, or now you need to intermittent fast, you know, start tomorrow, go slow. Take your time. Explore it. Try a little bit of it. You know, I think I know from all the people I work with that it can be very threatening, you know, when all of a sudden, you know, I talk about intermittent fasting. I've been doing intermittent fasting for years, and I love it. But oftentimes when I share it with people, clients who come to see me, it feels very threatening fast for any length of time. And so, you know, we need to baby step our way into a lot of the newer research that comes out about diet nutrition.
Yeah. Well, if you could offer just one piece of encouragement or advice to any of the emotional eaters out there that may be listening, what would you say?
I always want to say to people, I always want to give hope. That is always where I want to go when people ask me about advice, is that because I am a fully recovered emotional eater, I'm walking, breathing example of it, and I know how challenging the journey can be, and it's kind of two steps forward, four steps back, three steps forward. You know, there's a lot of, I see this with people I've worked with where, you know, the recovery takes time, but there really is genuine and good full recovery. But I want to say, keep the hope, you know, stay hopeful. It's like I said, it's not going to be overnight. You didn't become an emotional eater overnight. You're not going to resolve your emotional eating overnight. But as you learn to practice the skills that you might be missing, and even in my first book, Skills, Body Balancing Principles and Soul Care Practices that you might be missing, you will begin to make a dent in your eating, and that will feel good, and that will encourage you to keep going. So keep the faith. And the other thing I say is find someone, either work with me or find someone in your area, or, you know, I do teleseminars too. Work with someone who knows this stuff and who has walked this path ahead of you. Sometimes you can't do it all alone.
Makes perfect sense. Julie, thank you so much for coming on. I just want to acknowledge you and thank you for taking a subject that I think a lot of people don't like to talk about. And I think when we talked about finding people that that'll help nurture them, I think sometimes people don't reach out because it's not something that they want to talk about. And I love the fact that, you know, you're putting it out there, you're providing information, and you're helping a lot of people. So thank you for that.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure to come and talk about this subject, my favorite subject.
All right. Okay. Well, thank you. And for everybody out there, be sure to put us on your your calendar and tune in next Monday when our special guest will be Dr. Stephen A. Curley to discuss his new book, In My Hands. He has compelling stories. He is a surgeon, and there are stories of his patients who are fighting cancer. And please visit our archives of past interviews at answersforthefamily.com. We've had so many great guests that if you go on and you type in whatever the subject is, we've probably had somebody that is very knowledgeable on that subject and has spoken on it. Or you can subscribe to the shows through iTunes and they'll be sent to you immediately or through Stitcher or YouTube. And if you like what you hear, please leave a review. It will help us reach more people and we greatly appreciate it. Next time you're on Facebook or Twitter, please remember to stop by our page. Check out some of our latest posts. If you like them, please like us and spread the word that Answers for the Family is the place to go for inspiration, education, and innovation in the areas of health, happiness, security, and fun for you and your family. Be good humans and be with us again next week on Answers for the Family.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.